Hey everyone, thanks for listening to The Confluence. This is producer Megan Harris with a quick note about today's broadcast. Due to an error in recording, the show begins with sound quality well below our usual standard. That is, of course, no fault of our guests, but if it bothers you, you can rejoin the conversation about 8 minutes in. That's where host Kevin Gavin continues his chat with Pittsburgh Police canine trainer Sergeant Sean Duffy and his newest recruit, bloodhound puppy Cappy, who's knocking around with them in the WESA studios. From there, we promise, the quality vastly improves. Enjoy the show.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. They're known for sniffing out drugs, for tracking, apprehending suspects, but they're also invaluable for locating missing persons. They are officers in the Pittsburgh Police Bureau's K-9 unit. Sergeant Sean Duffy oversees that unit, and the newest member is Cappy. Welcome to both of you to The Confluence.
Good morning.
Good morning, Sergeant. Lovable and friendly might not be the attributes that immediately come to mind when you think of the four-legged officers of the K-9 unit, maybe loyal, courageous, and sometimes even fierce. Sean, is that because of the very different assignments that the members of the K-9 unit have?
Yes. Cappy is he's an extremely friendly dog. He's not going to have any aggression training on him at all, so he can be approached by just anyone, and he loves everybody.
Mm-hmm. He's a bloodhound.
Yes, he is.
Different from the other members of the K-9 unit, which are what species?
The K-9 unit?
Yeah,
the majority of the dogs. Well, we have German Shepherds, Belgian Malinois, we have one Dutch Shepherd, and we have some Belgian Malinois and German Shepherd mixes.
Mm-hmm. Those different attributes, it's all how they're trained, is it not, to be friendly or to be, how would you describe it?
Well, each dog has its own personality, so we don't train the dogs to be aggressive. We train the dogs to apprehend suspects by biting, and they're not doing it to be aggressive. They're doing what they're told to do. Like, you'll see when the dog is biting someone, his tail will be wagging because he's making biting somebody is the ultimate reward for them. They get rewarded when they do well. So they do that not out of ferocity. They do it out of training. They're training.
There was a great amount of attention a few years ago. For the K-9 unit, and it was because of a very unfortunate, a sad incident. It was Officer Rocco who was killed in the line of duty. This public attention, even sort of outcry or pouring of sympathy, what does that mean to you as the leader of the K-9 unit, as Cappy is up on our table trying to take part in this interview?
It means a lot. People just love dogs, and they actually love them so much that they don't realize, like, when Officer Rocco, K-9 Rocco, right, was killed by stabbing, that the officer was also stabbed.
Right.
And a lot of people don't know that. You know, they don't care about the human. They care about the dog. But, that's great that people love them so much, and they're an invaluable tool for us.
There was also an outpouring of support for a bloodhound puppy that you had who just died unexpectedly, and Cappy is replacing Loki.
Correct.
So what happened? What do we know about Loki?
Loki, he was donated to us by Hanson Hounds in Iowa, and he was we got him when he was 7 weeks old. And he passed away unexpectedly when he was 10 weeks old, right before we even began his training. He died of aspirated pneumonia.
Hmm. Okay, so Cappy is about 17 months old?
Correct.
Okay, so where is he in his training? How soon will he be deployed in the field? Then I want to talk about why you feel so important to have a bloodhound to find missing persons.
Cappy is fully trained. Mm-hmm. He's ready to go. The only thing is, he's tearing the place apart.
If you hear something rustling, that's Cappy just sort of looking through the glass, looking at our producers, looking at the engineer, just wanting to be petted by Sergeant Duffy. So if you hear a little rustling, that's Cappy.
Hey, buddy. Okay,
He is fully trained and he'll go in the field when.
He's fully trained. His handler is not. We have to train. Well, his handler's fully trained on patrol dogs. Never had a scent hound, a scent discrimination hound. So we have to train his handler on how to work Cappy.
Okay. So Cappy, where's Cappy from?
Cappy, we got him from Haw River, North Carolina, which is just outside of Burlington.
Is this where bloodhounds tend to be raised, or what? Or it just happened to be that way?
It just happened to be that way. Bloodhounds are raised all over the country, and they're utilized all over the country. There's that stereotype of the southern officer with the bloodhound, but maybe they are more frequently used down there. We could use a lot more of them up here.
Okay, so let's get into the why. Why did you feel a bloodhound was necessary to add to the K-9 unit, and when did that start happening?
Well, when I took the unit over a little over a year ago, and I recognized the need for that, and I found out when I vocalized that the public safety director, Wendell Hissrich, he was also had that in mind, and that was one of his pet projects. So it made it very easy for us to go forward on this, and by getting Loki, that started it. But Loki would have had to have been trained for a whole year. Mike Craig and Linda Dunn of Public Safety Dogs Incorporated in Haw River, North Carolina, fully trained him, rescued him first, fully trained him, and when they saw on the news that Loki died, they contacted the Pittsburgh police and told us, hey, we have this dog for you. And I was told to vet him to make sure that he was legitimate, because we never heard of Public Safety Dogs Incorporated. I called a lot of his references, and he has dogs all over the country, even in Honolulu.
Right.
So I made arrangements to go down there, and we went down there, me and Officer Glenn Bogert, went down to Burlington for 4 days, and they taught us how to work him.
Okay. Well, all right. So Cappy's here. And so tell us about the process. What makes bloodhounds so good at finding missing people? And, you know, we get releases quite often from the public safety office, from media relations, from Chris Tonieri. He's also here in studio with us, with Cappy, you know, talking about this child is missing or this adult has wandered off. Maybe they have Alzheimer's or some other, disability. So what makes them so good at finding a missing person?
Well, the bloodhound is like the Cadillac of dog noses. They are the most sensitive nose in the dog canine world, and they have some estimates where their sense of smell is 10,000 times more than a human being's. They can pick up on two skin cells.
Okay, so let's get a sense of you get alerted that there is a missing person. What are the steps as Cappy will, when he's ready to be deployed in the field? What will happen as far as getting the original scent of the missing individual, and then how you proceed?
Well, the handler would respond to the scene. If it's a missing person, they know where the person's missing from. We would get an article that was touched by that individual, and we can either scent the dog with the article, or we could extract the scent onto a gauze with an STU-100.
What's that?
It's a scent transfer unit. It's basically a vacuum that can extract scent off of an object onto a surgical gauze, and we can store it indefinitely in a Ziploc bag.
Okay. So Cappy gets the scent, and then what's the process?
Well, you would give Cappy the scent. You would find out where you want to start your trail,
right,
where the last person was last seen. You basically wave the scent in front of his nose, and then you give him the command to start searching. Once you start searching, he starts searching, and then you read him on whether or not he's on the trail or not. And if he gets distracted, you tell him to get back to work, and he takes you to where the person's at.
Mm-hmm.
And they can go tremendous distances. It can be weeks old, months old tracks,
And they still detect
something. I personally saw two German Shepherds down in Burlington, North Carolina, follow a three-week-old track that was laid 3 weeks ago, 3 weeks prior.
Right.
And they went 1 mile through the city, and they pre-scented the dog with the person's odor, and they went 1 mile through the city after rain, all the weather, 3 weeks later, and both of the German Shepherds found the person.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I want to ask you this. You mentioned Cappy was fully trained out of state. Is there any special training about the terrain in the Pittsburgh area that will be added to Cappy's training?
No, terrain doesn't mean anything.
Okay.
The thing that makes him most valuable is he'll be able to trail someone through urban environments like downtown Pittsburgh or Shadyside,
which has all kind of odors and smells.
Right. Well, he's not looking for anything but the odor that you put him on.
So he won't get distracted by other odors that are present.
Well, if there's food laying on the ground, but you just tell him to get back to work and to leave it.
Okay.
You know, but he knows once you put that odor on him and you give him the command to start searching, you only give that command once, and he'll remain focused on that until he finds that odor.
Okay, so he finds the missing person. It's a child. It's an adult who's wandered off. Now, the contact with the individual is much different than with another member of your canine unit who was going after a suspect.
Correct.
But tell, what's that encounter like when Cappy, or what do you anticipate it to be like when he locates that missing person? How's he going to react?
Cappy will, when the scent trail gets fresher, he'll pick up his pace, and he'll go up to the individual that we're looking for, and he'll walk up and sniff that individual and verify that that's the individual he's looking for, and he'll just sit down in front of the person.
And so the person is not intimidated or afraid, because Cappy's a fairly big boy.
Yes, he is, but he's adorable, and nobody's afraid of Cappy.
Okay, so Cappy is the only bloodhound. Is there? Do you think there'll be a need for additional bloodhounds in the canine unit at this point?
There may be. We are working on getting Mr. Craig and Linda Dunn up here with their team of people to train six of my dogs in scent discrimination, the patrol dogs in scent discrimination, which would...
What is scent discrimination? So missing persons versus
our dogs right now are tracking dogs. They do ground disturbance. Like if somebody runs through the woods, they can pick up on the disturbances, but they're not searching for a specific individual. Scent discrimination is you provide a scent to the dog, and they are looking only for that individual.
Sergeant Sean Duffy oversees the canine unit in the Pittsburgh Police Bureau unit, and the newest member is Cappy, who is hiding behind the drapes in our studio right now. Sergeant Duffy, thanks so much for coming in. Thanks for bringing Cappy, and very good luck to the two of you.
Thank you for having us.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Coming up on The Confluence, one Northside chef and business owner is teaching his neighborhood to prepare fresh, affordable food. The Catholic Diocese held a special service Sunday to kick off its year of repentance. Hear what Bishop David Zubik had to say and how parishioners are responding. And clean needle exchanges can save lives, but it can be difficult to get a neighborhood on board. What could a new South Hills location for Prevention Point Pittsburgh do for those struggling with opioid abuse in Carrick? Those questions, conversations, and more. That's next when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
President James Monroe made a 5-day visit to Pittsburgh in September of 1817. At the time, the Pittsburgh Gazette said the city had never before exhibited a spectacle so lively and interesting as was presented on the arrival of the president. Monroe stopped in western PA as a part of a tour of the eastern and northern parts of the U.S. While in the area, he visited Pittsburgh, Fayette County, and Canonsburg. The fervor surrounding the fifth president's visit was only topped by the arrival of President-elect Abraham Lincoln, 44 years later. I'm Mick Stinelli for the Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Teaching people to prepare fresh food that's both nutritious and affordable, that's Northside Chef Claudie Pierre's mission. For the past 4 years, Pierre has run a community program called EAT, which stands for Empowering, Awareness, and Training. He spoke about the initiative with 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort.
Why do you take time out from your restaurant and your catering businesses to hold healthy cooking demonstrations and workshops?
Well, health is wealth. So as we're trying to pour into our communities and, you know, talk about the sustainability of our neighborhoods, the one thing that we have to remember is self-care. We have to eat right. If you eat crap, you're going to feel like crap. Not just how to prepare meals, but also how to source it, how to find affordable, tasty opportunities for you to be healthy.
Now, you've been holding workshops. You had one at a church. What do you do there?
So it was with the AARP at Ebenezer Baptist Church in the historic Hill District. We did a healthy cooking demonstration, talked about the benefits of, you know, roasting or baking chicken, fresh vegetables and fruit, you know, not having to cook your greens for 10 hours, you know, with a ham shank in order for it to taste good. So just really talk to some of our senior citizens about the benefits of working out and actually eating healthy at even a more seasoned age so that they're living longer and feel better.
And some of our communities, however, are considered food deserts. They don't have a place where you can go and buy fresh produce.
One thing I will say is that people say it's expensive because of that reason, right? They say, hey, you know what? It's hard to find good food. It's hard to locate good food and pay for it. But I say, which one is more expensive? Going to the hospital because you have high blood pressure and diabetes and you need all types of medications? Or taking some time out and actually making a list, finding out where their local farmers market is, calling some friends, going together, you know, putting some thought and some money behind you eating healthy. That's not as expensive as the bills that you're going to accumulate because you're not healthy. So when you break it down like that, it's a long-term investment, and it's actually really inexpensive.
But why is that important to you?
It's important to me because I was fortunate enough to have some really strong mentors, and I got to see Black excellence, and I got to see minorities. I got to see, you know, people from different countries come here and have a wonderful opportunity to grow businesses. I got to see, you know, teachers who didn't just teach, they helped the community. They were here, and I am that person. And so I have to pay it forward. I have to make sure that we lift as we climb. And we have to make sure that, you know, these next generations, as they're getting disconnected from the social aspect of things, that we connect back with them. And what's the best way to do it? Through their stomachs. Yes.
Thank you very much, Chef Claudie Pierre.
Yeah, thank you.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh Catholic Bishop David Zubik led a special service Sunday afternoon at St. Paul Cathedral to begin what the diocese is calling a year of repentance in the wake of the decades of sexual abuse of children by clergy.
I know so many of you, so many of us, are sharing the experience that Jesus had on the cross. Feeling betrayed by an offender who baptized you, married you, inspired you, heard your confession, or supported you in your vocation to the priesthood, or maybe feeling betrayed by me or other leaders in the church.
90.5 WESA's identity and social justice reporter, Virginia Alvino Young, was there yesterday, and she joins us in the studio now. Welcome, Virginia.
Hi, Kevin.
What was the atmosphere, the vibe?
I mean, I'd say there were maybe like 100 folks there, pretty diverse. The current class of seminarians were there, some additional clergymen from parishes around the diocese, families as well. But it was really a time to kind of observe the particular ceremonial aspects of this special service and to sort of hear Zubik's very specific homily that he had to give on Sunday.
In that sound clip that we just heard from Bishop Zubik said, quote, "or maybe feeling betrayed by me or other leaders in the church," end quote. Is this farther than he's gone in earlier apologies over the course of the last month or so?
Right. So he's said, you know, "I'm sorry," plenty of times. This is one of the first times I've heard him sort of explicitly implicate himself in some way. I mean, in this grand jury report, he is named about 100 times as being a participant under then Bishop Donald Worrell. You know, he was participating in the process of relocating priests to different parishes who were facing allegations. And this is the first time he's kind of acknowledging that.
Mm-hmm. So he said, "I'm sorry." So did you speak with parishioners? Did they speak with you either before or after?
I got to say, I tried. I tried my best. It's very common for parishioners to really not want to speak after Mass, especially one that specifically acknowledges abuse within the church. Yesterday was particularly a tough sell. I did speak with one man who said, yes, this is, you know, not the end-all be-all, but this is a great start. It really shows how committed the bishop is to making a change.
All right. So not the end-all. So did the bishop in any way say this is the beginning, this is a step? Because let's face it, I believe it was over the weekend or Friday, the bishops of all the dioceses issued a letter saying they supported a compensation fund, but not lifting the statute of limitations for civil suits. And there is a rally, I believe, today calling on state lawmakers to open up that window for suits.
So the response is kind of twofold. Let's kind of zoom into Pittsburgh specifically with Bishop David Zubik. This year of repentance, the holy hour, right, the fasting, the praying, that's the spiritual response. That's saying, you know, the clergy in the diocese need to sort of cleanse and pray for victims. We need to find a way to walk forward with survivors in their healing process. So no mention of, you know, statute of limitations during his homily, right? Late Friday night, all of the Pennsylvania bishops through the Pennsylvania Catholic Conference say, you know, we need to take some kind of step forward. And our idea, our proposal that we're kind of kicking around is this compensation fund. This is something that we've seen in other states that have faced similar issues within their Catholic Church. Survivors are saying, that is just, that's not enough. Number one, it would skirt sort of the it would put a cap right on the financial liability that they would be able to put forth that would go towards living survivors. But also, without this this so-called civil window, which would allow for sort of retroactive lawsuits, they never have to go to court. They never have to appear before a judge. The church never has to potentially disclose additional documentation. And so when survivors are talking about they're looking for justice, it's not just monetary. It's this system of transparency that they're looking for as well. And the church and the bishops flat out said, no, we do not support this. This would inevitably result in our bankruptcy.
Right. And that's just it. And bankruptcy means they couldn't have the funds to do charitable works that they do. That's their argument.
That's their argument. It's really complicated, right? Because survivors and advocates are saying, you know, this is just a maneuver to sort of skirt having to appear in court. And what we've seen in other dioceses also is just that it would potentially also put a cap on the monetary retribution that could go forward. Bankruptcy really is a complicated thing, so it wouldn't necessarily mean they have to shut their doors. Lots of other dioceses have declared bankruptcy. They're all still operating. So what it would actually mean for their operations isn't exactly known.
All right. Virginia Alvino Young is WESA's identity and social justice reporter. Virginia, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The hotspot for the opioid crisis in the Pittsburgh area is Carrick, which is now in line to get a clean needle exchange site, the fourth in the city to be operated by the nonprofit Prevention Point Pittsburgh. Aaron Arnold is the executive director of Prevention Point Pittsburgh. Gus Durena is a recovering drug user and is recovery director for ARC. That's the Allegheny Recovery Crew. And Sarah Bowden is health and science reporter for WESA. Welcome to you all.
Hey, Kevin.
Hello.
Good morning.
So, Aaron, it's not a done deal yet, but the County Board of Health has approved a request for the needle exchange site in Carrick. Aaron, what would the site entail?
So the sites that we operate are from a mobile vehicle, mm-hmm. and it would be one day a week in the afternoons. The Board of Health unanimously approved Thursday afternoons, and we had worked with a church in Carrick, the Spencer United Methodist Church, who was willing to let us use their parking lot. So the plan is just to bring a vehicle there one day a week and offer services out of it and make sure that it becomes a resource for people who might be in need or have any sort of social services, drug treatment, anything that they can possibly need, we can help them with.
Sarah, and I said it's not a done deal yet. There are still some steps to go. What is still needed?
Correct. The last step, correct me if I'm wrong, Aaron, is that it has to be approved by the city council.
That's right. The regulations that were promulgated in 2005 allow us to operate a syringe services program legally, but it's an approval process where we have to demonstrate community support, go to the Board of Health, and then the final step is the municipality where it's being operated. It provides approval.
And earlier this month, it was approved by the Board of Health, so that's one hurdle that's out of the way.
Correct. Yep. Yeah, we're almost at the finish line now.
This is interesting because it involves both city and county entities, because the Board of Health is a county entity, and of course it's in the city, so city council has to get involved. So that's extra hurdles or what?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a little bit more work to be able to go through the municipalities. And I think, you know, every municipality is unique. And so everybody has their own set of politics. Everybody has their own set of community standards. And so what we see is, you know, oftentimes the Board of Health will approve, and then it takes a little bit more time to get it through the final step. So far, all of our sites are in the city, so we've always had to go through the city council.
Gus, I understand that you've benefited from the clean needle exchange. Can you tell us how so?
Well, when I was an active heroin user, and I've been clean for almost 9 years now, and towards the end of my run, I was using needles from anywhere I could get them, and you know, having clean needles was always a big thing, and we would just use them. We wouldn't stop using because we didn't have a clean needle. We would use anything or anybody's needle, and I heard about the needle exchange, and you would go there with your old dirty needles, and they would give you as many needles as you would need for to get through the week so that you would be able to use clean needles with every injection. And that's what I did. I had a clean needle for every injection, and it saved me countless wounds on my body from abscesses, from broken and dirty needles. And also, you know, like back then, I didn't care. You know, there's AIDS and hepatitis C and endocarditis and all those things that would normally scare the life out of a normal person. But when you're a drug addict and you're under that craving and you got to get something in you, none of that stuff matters. I could have a guy sitting next to me who I know has AIDS. And if I have the drugs and I don't have a needle, I will use his needle to inject myself with. Now, you know, I say, wow, would you do that? Well, you haven't been under a heroin addiction craving, you know, and a needle sitting right there, either do it or don't. And most times you do. So today I'm clean. And because of the needle exchange, I'm not battling Hep C, I'm not battling AIDS, I'm not battling endocarditis and a number of other things that would really inhibit my recovery today. Like, I'm working on a program of recovery, which is okay, and it's doable, but it would be a lot harder if I had Hep C or if I had endocarditis or any of those other things. So I know how valuable this is to keep people healthy, you know, until they one day might get a chance to be in recovery. So I know how valuable that is, and it saved my life. I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the needle exchange.
That's what I was going to ask you. Did it save your life, or did getting off the heroin save your life, or was it both?
It's a continuum of care. You know, like, we have a continuum of care. First, you like to prevent the drug use if you can. And then, you know, sure, you want to make it as less harmful as possible so that somebody can live long enough to get recovery. So it's really all combined into one. You know, if I didn't have the needle exchange, I wouldn't have recovery today. I couldn't get to recovery first. So I had to stay alive long enough to have a shot at getting recovery. So the needle exchange provided the time and the space I needed to finally end my heroin addiction and recover.
And something that's really special about Prevention Point is that for people who are ready to, you guys do a really nice job of connecting users with services.
That's right. So in addition to the syringe services program, we have many, many other services. So we also prescribe naloxone, which is the overdose reversing medication. We test people for HIV, hepatitis C, and other STDs. We have a wound care program that volunteer doctors and nurses interact with people and provide low-threshold health care. And we have a service navigator on staff who assists people with accessing any type of services they need. Last year, in 2017, our service navigator assisted 427 people with getting into treatment, and that was just in 1 year with one person. And these were all people who came to us and said, I'm ready. Today's the day. Please help me. And, you know, we were just grateful to be able to be there for them in that time.
Aaron, you mentioned that the exchange, if the site is approved, if it will be a parking lot, that a vehicle stationed at Spencer United Methodist Church. Again, how frequently and what are your proposed hours?
So the proposal that was approved through the Board of Health is Thursday afternoons between the hours of 12 p.m. and 6 p.m. It's likely that we'll operate 12 p.m. to 3 p.m. to start. And then we just approved a longer, or we asked for approval for a longer window just in case we need to adjust at any point in the future. Because we have to go through this approval process for every little thing that we do related to the needle exchange program, we wanted to give ourselves some flexibility.
Okay, I won't ask any of you this. The church parking lot, the church's pastor, Matthew Price, urged the Board of Health to approve it, which they did. But do you sense, do you get the feeling, do you hear that there is still an attitude by some, many, yeah, fine, Prevention Point, Pittsburgh, need clean needle exchange, but not here, not in the old, not in my backyard. Gus, do you sense that still?
Right. I have actually moved in to a recovery house that we opened up right behind the Spencer Church. Actually, our recovery house will be the closest habitable house to the van itself. And I know how important it is to have the needles there. And I know the church people. I'm a Methodist, and my church isn't far from here, so I know a lot of the church people. And they were dead set against the needle exchange coming in. There was we found out later, we met with their board, and we found out later that we were really in a bad spot. There was like 9 people that did not want it, and 3 people that were willing to listen, and 1 person that was going to say, you know, go ahead. And that's sort of, that's just normal. I mean, if you said you were going to put a needle exchange and I'm not informed or knowing anything, I'm thinking of an ice cream truck with bell ringing and people throwing needles out the back. I mean, these are the kinds of things that go through people's minds, right? And, of course, it's just natural. But once Aaron and I talked with the people and I told my story of the needle exchange and how it helped me and them knowing me and Aaron gave them the facts, they unanimously voted to put this needle exchange in their backyard. So the resistance that we feel is out there, and it's only natural, and it should be. You know, I would be concerned too, but we have a little more education. We're a little more informed. So if there is any of this resistance or people that haven't been informed yet, haven't sat down and heard the details and seen how this thing really works, of course, I understand why they're scared, and I think the only thing we can do is educate them a little more. Whether it's more public meetings or something to that effect, where they can be invited in so we can answer their questions and their concerns, because they have plenty of them. And where they're finding out or where they're coming from, I understand where they're coming from, but we have the answers. So we don't need to hide and do this. Like, just come and ask us. We will answer every question and address every concern that you have, because we have the right answers for you. And that's what we did with the church, and we met at a council meeting up there, and the Block Watch people were pretty much the same thing, but when they heard what we did, they were okay with it too. So these are people that weren't at the council meeting or at the Block Watch. So
I think, you know, for me as a public health person, this feels like common sense. But if you put yourself in the mindset of somebody who lives in the neighborhoods that have been dealing with substance use and are the most impacted by substance use, then you can understand where people are coming from. They feel like this is extremely counterintuitive. They see it as potentially enabling in some way, shape, or form. And nothing could be further from the truth with that. You know, the dirty secret about needle exchange is that it's quite boring, actually. It's not, you know, it's not the Wild West. It's people coming down to, you know, participate in a medical or social service like anybody else.
Also, I'll point out that this is a van pulls up in the parking lot and hangs out for 3 hours. This isn't a permanent fixture. They don't have a storefront.
like, it's not part of the neighborhood for most of the week.
Right. And if they didn't know that we were there, they would have no idea. The places where we operate now, the zone police who are in charge of those areas, they actually forget that we're there all the time. And they say, we would honestly not know where you operate unless you keep coming back and telling us and offering to train the new officers about your program, because it's just really a non-issue, frankly.
Right. So why aren't three sites enough?
Well, I think, you know, in Pittsburgh, there's the great tendency to not want to leave your community or not cross a river. And so our current sites are all in the East End and the Hill District. And then
you have one on the north side as
well. So we recently added a Perry Hilltop site. And what we saw when we added the Perry Hilltop site about 2 years ago now was that a whole different set of people showed up to that site, people we had never seen at our other locations before. And some of them were in pretty bad shape. They're from isolated neighborhoods that don't have a lot of services in them. And so when they started coming, we thought, wow, here's a whole network of people that we have never touched before. They'd never even heard of the needle exchange program. And some of them have been using injection drugs for many, many years. So with South Pittsburgh, we knew we weren't reaching people down there. We were seeing a small subset of people that were willing to travel to our other sites. But when you look at the overdose data, when you look at the new hepatitis C reports, the case reports that are being delivered now to the county, you see Carrick, Mount Oliver, the South Hilltop area is far and above the most highly impacted area. So we thought we better go to them so that we can make it easier for people to participate in the program or receive the public health tools that they need.
Also, I'll point out that if you look at a heat map for the most overdose fatalities in the city, again, Carrick is the hot spot, and Prevention Point hands out naloxone in addition to needles. And naloxone is the medication that can revive someone from an overdose. And so they're providing a lot of services, not just syringes.
Right. I want to get your reaction to that, Gust and Aaron. So it's not only a clean needle to prevent the spread of disease, it's also the distribution of the naloxone, which could save a life immediately. Gus?
Right. And that's very important, because if someone's dead, they have no opportunity to recover. We also know once you bring them back to life, now there's a lot of work that needs to be done with this person to move them on to life, and that's a lot what I do in recovery. But you can't get the recovery unless you're alive, and that's a big part of it. But more than all that, you know, when I was visiting Prevention Point 11, 12 years ago and was in that position of most heroin addicts are today, you know, you're in a deep, dark spot, and there's not much light or anything coming through to make you think that maybe there's somebody out there or some way out. And you don't really have contact with people because you're out there in the streets. So the needle exchange was one of the few places, well, probably the only place that I went to where people actually cared about me, treated me like a human being, and made me feel like, you know, that I'm worth something. And that's the biggest thing that the needle exchange does, is when these people come who feel that there's no hope out there, nobody cares about me, everybody wants to be dead and gone. That's what we believe. And it's, you know, we really believe that in our hearts. And then we go to the needle exchange, and these people down there are happy to help us with what we need, even though it is needles. And you're like, well, who would give needles? But for us, that's like a, you know, that's the $1 million check. Like, you know, somebody wants to give me something like a clean needle, right? They're concerned about me and where I'm at today. And that's what the needle exchange does. And I know the care community needs that, because these kids are in the alleyways and they're in the shadows, and they don't believe that there's anybody out there anywhere that helps them. And this is like their first point of contact sometimes, where they'll be treated like that. And my recovery house is right there, and we'll be there, you know, when they're getting their needles, and there will only be a few of them. We're going to try to, you know, interact if we can, if they're ready.
All right, we have just about a minute left. So everything we said is about the city, looking beyond city limits, Aaron, for other sites?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that some of the most affected areas are places outside of the city limits. I think our intent with this current site was to make this the last city site that we are doing, and then moving on to trying to get some outside of the city. Of course, you know, as you can tell, you know, right now we're being delayed in getting approval through city council. We're not quite sure what that's about. We hope that it's, you know, just a momentary delay, and that, you know, we're on to the final approval very quickly. But when we go out to the county, we're probably going to run into even greater situations like that. some of the municipalities are managed by very small boards of commissioners. There are people that don't have a lot of experience with the type of work we do. At least in the city, you know, people have some exposure to public health services. And so it's going to be a challenge to go outside of the city, but that's a challenge that we have to take on. We're in the midst of an overdose crisis. There's, you know, HIV and hepatitis C being transmitted at rates that are, you know, we thought were over. But we have to get to these people. And as much work as it takes, we'll take it on.
Aaron Arnold is the executive director of Prevention Point Pittsburgh. Gus DeRenna is a recovering addict and is recovery director for ARC, that's Allegheny Recovery Crew. And Sarah Bowden is health and science reporter for WESA. Thanks to all of you.
Thanks,
Thank
Kevin.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next show, it is a gathering space. It's a gallery. It's a place to exchange ideas and connect artists with the community. We'll meet the co-founder of Boom. Today's program was engineered by Katie Blackley. The assistant producer is Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.